Good afternoon, Education Finance Committee. We'll come to order. Welcome back from break, everybody. Good to see you all again. Today, we are going to hear the governor's supplemental budget proposal. I was happy to introduce that, so it's House File 4328. But before we do that, we should probably move the minutes. Representative Wills, would you like to take care of that for us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the minutes of March 29th, 2018.
All right. Any questions or comments on the minutes? Not seeing any. All in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Minutes are approved. Thank you. All right. So with that, we will go ahead and get right to the business for today. We'll start with the commissioner. And I will go ahead and move House File 4328. And what is our motion? To be referred to the Committee on Taxes. But for today, my intention is to lay it over. We'll have the department present, and then we'll go to member questions. We do have a number of testifiers, people indicating they wanted to testify. If we have time and we finish all of that by 2:45, I've got still the remaining testifiers from the policy bill, which we started, everyone remembers, way back before break. We also have reserved the room, committee room, at 5 o'clock or call of the chair for tonight to finish all that. So we'll just see how much we get done today in regular committee time, and then I'll make an announcement. So with that, welcome. Good to see you, Commissioner. Hopefully you had a nice break as well, or maybe you weren't on break, but time away from the legislature.
President Erickson brought me back. Madam Chair, committee members, Brenda Caselius, Commissioner of Education, thank you so much for having me here. First, I'd like to say thank you for your patience in getting the governor's bill. We got that to you, and we're really excited to talk about it today. I'm going to go ahead and highlight a few of the high points first, and then I'll have Adosh Uni, Government Relations Director, as well as Dr. Tom Melcher, our School Finance Director, speak to the specific provisions within the bill. And then I'll be available for questions with my team. Also, Wayne Nguyen is here as well, who is assisting us with this work. So first, just thank you so much, Madam Chair, for covering the governor's budget bill, for carrying the governor's budget bill, and providing us the opportunity to walk the committee through the governor's bill. Of note, the bill contains straightforward procedures and proposals that will improve school safety, and improve and support our supports for our youngest learners, assist schools in special education costs, and bringing down the cross subsidy somewhat, and maintaining our commitment to our American Indian students. This morning, I believe you may be in receipt. I know that the governor sent a letter to the leadership regarding his wish for some bipartisan bills to move more quickly to his desk if possible. I know that there's a lot of support, bipartisan support, for several of the measures he mentioned in his letter, but particularly for the work that we're doing around school safety. I know that there's bipartisan support with mental health. There's bipartisan support, although we have not agreed yet on the means around the school levy, and also some of the language around the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act. So we think that there's some really good work that's been done. There's broad agreement, and it'd be nice if we could send a clean bill to the governor's desk as soon as possible so that our children are safe in school and schools can get started on their supports as well. Next, I'd like to highlight, of course, the proposal that we worked on quite diligently a few years ago with the School Readiness Plus and Voluntary Pre-Kindergarten to expand access to more children. As you know, we have 22,500 students now accessing state-funded preschool. And this is just an amazing opportunity for our kids in light of the stark disparities that exist between our white students and our non-white students, our poor students and our more affluent students, and this is just the critical work that lays ahead of us, is to eliminate these disparities, and preschool is an absolute way to do that. We also realize that we're getting to them, some of our students in the highest need, a little bit too late. So some of the policy changes within the bill are to allow for our scholarship program to be available for children who are birth to three. Of course, we already do that for teenage moms, but we think it is really important to do that more broadly. There's some also more funding for Help Me Grow through the Children's Cabinet, and this funding is a resource for parents in order to get more access to resources and support systems for their youngest children. And then, of course, there's some needed changes to the way that we allocate funds out in the scholarships, some changes to Head Starts and our background checks with that, and kindergarten student counts. That is clarifying some of the early childhood provisions within the bill. As you know, you've received several letters, as have I, regarding the incredible strain of the special education cross-subsidy. This is a supplemental year, so it's challenging to do anything within the space, and I know that Representative Erickson has proposed in her policy bill some working group, but the governor feels that we could get started on this and start at least addressing some of the growth in our special ed and in the cross-subsidy and try to ease some of that growth and not wait on that. So he proposes additional investments in the special education cross-subsidy and buying that down. And then just I'd like to share with you, and I shared this in my comments before when the governor was just releasing his supplemental priorities around our BIE schools and our commitment to our American Indian kids, and that they'd be protected and have an equal education to all other kids within the state of Minnesota. And we have proposed additionally funding them at the level of the average per pupil, which is the fairest thing to do. And right now, that funding we've done for two sessions has been just one time, and each time we have to come back to it. And it'd be really nice to just have that be permanent for them so that they can continually plan for those interventions, hire the staff that they need, and not have to be faced with the really tough decisions on whether this money might go away or not. I had talked previously about the GED and providing that for free to our students who have not earned their diploma, and how important a step this is for creating the world's best workforce and giving all Minnesotans a chance to have the credentials and opportunities to succeed in life. So it's a really small amount of funding to ensure that all people are able to take the GED, or if we have more than just the GED, any high school equivalency test. So that's included there. And then we have some fixes to the QComp. Because we're at the limit in the cap of QComp and we have not increased the funding for more to get into the program, we're having to prorate that funding among the districts who are existing if enrollment changes occur. So we'd like to just have some flexibility with that cap so that we'd be able to not have to prorate the current and existing members who are in the QComp program. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tom and Adosh and let them walk you through the bill and all the particulars, and then I'll be available for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tom Melcher from the Department of Education. I'll be walking through Article 1 of the bill. Article 1, Section 1 and Section 3 through 9 would simplify the calculation of referendum and local optional revenue and make the calculations more transparent by eliminating the annual recalculation of referendum allowances based on the amount of local optional revenue that a school district selects for that year, and by moving the $300 of referendum revenue that's accessible to boards based on a board resolution rather than an election from the referendum statute to the local optional revenue statute, so that we'd have a cleaner referendum. All of the referendums would be based on an actual vote. All of the local optional revenue would reflect the sources that are available by board action, both currently within the referendum, currently local optional. So we'd have a $724 local optional revenue. It would be a two-tiered formula. The tier one of the referendum, the first $300 per pupil, would move over to local optional. so that the equalization would stay the same. There would be no change in state aid or local levy for any school district. It would just be more straightforward, less risk of error, less paperwork. Generally, the system works okay now, but we occasionally have districts that get confused. We had to have a special bill a few years ago for Owatonna because they confused how the referendum ballot should be worded. Just this year, the Foley School District ended up levying $66,000 more than they needed to, because as they were swapping out the local optional in the first tier referendum, they asked for too much local optional, and that cut into their first tier of the referendum, which has a higher state share, and so they ended up costing their taxpayers $66,000 and getting less state aid. So we're trying to make things a little more simple, straightforward by making those changes. I can walk through the details of the language in those sections if you would like, or I could move on to the other.
Is there anyone who would like the detailed explanation? I think we're okay with the overview. Thanks, Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, if not, then Section 2 of Article 1 is increasing the equalizing factors for the operating capital levy to offset the levy increases that occur in the governor's voluntary pre-K proposal by continuing the number of slots for voluntary pre-K and expanding them by 5% a year. That creates some increases in school district levies, most notably the referendum levies that are based on a rate per pupil unit. So by increasing the equalizing factors for the operating capital program, we're offsetting that. It's about a $3.2 million impact in fiscal 20 and about a $3.5 million impact in fiscal 21 that's being neutralized by the change in the operating capital equalizing factor. Then beginning on Section 10 of Article 1, we get to the governor's recommendations for Safe Schools revenue, and these are in two parts. For fiscal year 19 only, because the school districts have already made their $36 per pupil levy, the governor is recommending an increase of $18 per pupil, all state aid, and he does that by raising the allowance from $36 per pupil to $54 per pupil. There's also a new floor added, which would be $22,500 per district, so the districts that have fewer than about 416 students would be at that $22,500 floor in fiscal year 19. The governor is also recommending that the Safe Schools revenue be increased for intermediate school districts and that cooperatives be added to that. The increase for cooperatives and intermediates would be $7.50 the first year times the pupil units of the member districts. Also, charter schools would receive the same increase as school districts. Currently, they don't qualify for Safe Schools revenue. This would give them $18 per pupil. So all of these increases in fiscal 19 are all state aid. Then beginning in fiscal year 2020, the governor would double the current allowance from $36 per pupil to $72 per pupil for the school district, so a $36 increase, and also the floor would go up to $30,000. That would maintain that situation where if you have less than 416 students, you're on the minimum. In addition to that, the revenue for the intermediate districts would also double from $15 to $30 per pupil. The cooperatives would get the same increase as the district, so they would go from zero to $15 per pupil, and the charter schools would go to $36 per pupil, so they would get the same increase as the school districts. The levy would become an equalized levy with an equalizing factor equal to 60% of the state average net tax capacity per pupil unit. What that would do is make sure that the school districts that have really low tax base are able to participate in the program. Currently, nearly all school districts levy the maximum for Safe Schools revenue, but we have a few districts with very low tax base, you know, Red Lake, Net Lake, Manoman. School districts that have really low tax base are not able to participate now because their tax base simply won't support levying $36 per pupil. By doing a relatively low equalizing factor, we're able to bring all of the districts into the program at a relatively low low cost to the state. So that's section 10 of the bill. Moving on to section 11, we have the general education appropriations, and what this is doing is making adjustments for the budget forecast, and then also adding $153,000 for a change in the kindergarten disabled student average daily membership count. So most of the change you see there are significant changes coming out of the November and February budget forecasts. We have more students than were projected at the end of the legislative session, and there was an issue with the way the appropriations were calculated for 2018 that are reflected in there. So the real change that's being asked for here is just $153,000 for the kindergarten disabled students, which we'll get to in a later article. And then we have the appropriation for the Safe Schools program. It would be a 90-10 appropriation, and the amount needed for fiscal year 19 would be $19,814,000, and that includes the funding for the intermediate and the co-op programs, as well as the school districts and charter schools. And then the final thing in Article 1 is Section 13, the repealer. That is repealing the board-approved $300 per pupil of the referendum. That would be shifted to local optional. We would no longer have such a thing as a board-approved referendum. It's kind of a contradiction in terms.
I don't see any questions, so I guess we'll keep moving on. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Adoshuni, Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. Article 2 is Education Excellence. The first two sections, Section 1, the language actually starts, if you're following along on the bill, on page 15, on 15.27. This section deletes language related to the reporting requirement of career and college readiness trajectory for grades 3 through 8, as determined on MCAs. Section 2, where the language starts on the bottom of page 16, that eliminates off-grade testing on the MCA.
Madam Chair, Tom Melcher, Department of Education. Article 2, Section 3 is dealing with the QCOMP program, and the governor is recommending that the cap on the basic QCOMP aid be adjusted so that the school districts that are currently in the program would not be prorated. The department approved districts for the program based on the enrollments that they had at the time they were admitted in the program. We've since had growing enrollment, and that's causing the QCOMP aid to be prorated at about 99% currently, and we're projecting it will go down to 98% as we have continued growth of enrollment. What that does, the way that the law is currently written, is the school districts in the program get their basic aid prorated, and then they levy more. So the impact of this recommendation is mostly to reduce the levy and to pay them the full aid that they're entitled to under the statute. There's a very slight increase in revenue because we have a few school districts that don't make the levy. So when their aid is not prorated, they would then get to the full aid amount, and there's a very slight increase for charter schools as well because their funding is based on the average for the charter schools.
Madam Chair, members, Adoshuni, sections 4 through 8, these provide clarifications in the Minnesota American Indian Teacher Training Program. It establishes that or clarifies that the four grantee partnerships, and just for your knowledge, that's Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota with the Duluth School District, Bemidji State University and Red Lake School District, Moorhead State University, and one of the districts located within the White Earth Reservation, and Augsburg College and Minneapolis. And so these four grantee partnerships can contract with tribal, technical, and community colleges and four-year post-secondary institutions to provide program services and recruit candidates. It eliminates the loan portion of the NITTP program and clarifies that their grants, which are essentially would be run as the same as the scholarship portion of the program right now, The language changes, there's more language changes in the program to eliminate the loans, an ability for a grantee to contract for partnerships with the tribal technical and community colleges. Provides clarifications around the student eligibility for the grants. This includes prioritization for students that have origins of original peoples in North America and maintains a cultural ID through tribal affiliation or community recognition. It also establishes a priority for students who are tribally enrolled and then to first and second generation descendants. It clearly states eligible programming is for those that are pursuing education level attainment, like associate's degree, bachelor's, master's, doctoral, and in education areas. And it requires the grantees and contract partners to hire American Indian work study students or other staff to provide programming regarding education professions to high school students. And then it says that at least 80% of the grant fundings to the institutions have to be used for student grants, and up to 20% may be used for recruitment or administration of those student grants.
Madam Chair, Tom Melcher, Article 2, Section 9 is maintaining the per pupil maximum for the Indian tribal contract aid at the $3,230. Where it's been for the last 4 years, from 2016 to 2019, rather than having that go down to $1,500 in 2020.
Madam Chair, Adosh Uni, Section 10 in Article 2 extends the time that districts have to seek reimbursement for administering the college entrance exams. It increases MDE's period of finalization of reimbursements from 24 months to 28 months.
Madam Chair, Tom Melcher, Section 11 is the appropriation language for the QCOMP program. That is to eliminate the proration of the QCOMP aid for the districts currently in the program.
Madam Chair, Section 12 is the repealer for Article 2. This repeals the loan provisions of the MITT program.
Thank you. And just to back up before we move on from this article, Dr. Melcher, do you know what the per pupil cumulative is at the tribal contract schools? I mean, I know, obviously, we know what our contribution is, but I think I've been trying to get this information before. Do you know what the per pupil is from all sources, federal and state?
Madam Chair, what we know is the amount that the tribal contract schools get from the federal basic aid, and then what we provide, and our formula is structured to provide those schools the same amount of money as if they were a regular school district after we subtract out that federal aid. I have the data on it, but I don't have it at the tip of my tongue, but we can.
That's fine. If you would just provide that to the committee, that would be helpful. Thank you. I'm sorry. We do have a question. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Uni, on page 21, under Section 7, Subdivision 6, there's new phrasing there in regard to the student grants, a student having origins in any of the original peoples of North America. Where does that phrase come from?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, this language was created between a collaboration between our Director of Indian Education and the Tribal Nations Education Committee. So the representatives of all the major tribes in the state consulted as a group with the representatives and then went back to their tribal boards and came up with the language that they thought was best representative of the student group that they wanted to capture.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. So that was locally decided. I have another question about the what becomes grants now. So there never were any loans issued according to a transmission that you sent to me, Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, yes. After we dug into the program administration for the four grantee institutions back to in the 1990s when the program started, we found that no loans were given out from the department ever, if we ever had the authority, or from the four grantee institutions.
Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one last question. Will there be an ongoing report of how these grants them play out, because I noticed in your message to me, we don't have that many in the teacher licensure area. Many have gone on to get higher degrees, and I'm not sure that was the reason for creating these scholarships back over 20 years ago. Mr. Rooney?
Mr. Rooney?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I'm sure we would be happy to provide more information on the programs, and if that happens to be in the form of language in a bill about reporting, I'm sure we can continue to work with you on that. I would say that a large portion of the program is for graduates or for participants in this program and to continue on in the education field. So I think with the transmission that we provided you, many of those individuals, if not most of all, are continuing on in some type of education field working with children in the K-12 context.
Representative. Madam Chair, just one final statement. However, I think this program was created so we would have American Indian teachers in our classrooms where it was needed. So I think we might need to revisit what the original origin of this provision was, because I was speaking with a former legislator who was a part of this just yesterday, and she said that it was geared for teachers in K-12. So we might want to discuss that later. Thank you.
All right, I don't see any other questions, so we can continue on.
Madam Chair, Tom Melcher, I'd like to move to Article 3. Article 3, Sections 1 through 4, are increasing the special education funding formula to reduce the special education cross-subsidy. Section 1 is deleting some obsolete language and also increasing the cap on special education growth by $30 per student, so school districts that are at the cap would receive a $30 per pupil increase. Section 2 is adjusting the initial special education formula by eliminating the use of the old formula, so instead of being the least of three formulas, it would be the lesser of the pupil-driven formula or the formula that uses all of the special ed costs, including fringe benefits. Also on page 26, the initial aid formula would be adjusted by changing the per pupil rates for the pupil-driven part of the special ed formula to reflect the 2017 cost study that the department is required to do each year to identify what the cost is per student for special education services. Section 3 is adjusting the excess cost aid. It reduces the subtraction for general education aid for one of the formulas, which increases the amount of excess cost aid. So as you can see, the governor's recommendations would increase various parts of the special education funding formula in order to provide an increase, reducing the cross-subsidy for most districts. Section 4 is the appropriation section, and that, again, is reflecting forecast changes as well as the recommended formula increases. If there are no questions on Article 3, I can go to Article 4, Madam Chair.
I think we can keep moving.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Article 4, Section 1 is dealing with the long-term facility maintenance levy, and it would allow school districts that are involved in a pairing agreement to allocate the levy for large indoor air quality, fire, and asbestos projects between the districts that are involved in the pairing agreement. So if one district has sent all of their high school kids to another district and the school that they're sending them to has a big indoor air quality project, it would allow the boards to mutually agree to split the levy on a fair basis between the two so that they're both contributing to that. No change in total cost to the state or the total levy. 123B61 Section 2 is clarifying that the current equipment bonding levy can be used for public announcement systems, emergency communication devices, or other equipment related to violence prevention and facility security. School districts can currently use the money for that purpose, but that's just kind of buried in other capital equipment now, so we wanted to be more explicit to make it clear to school districts that they can do equipment bonding to include those needs. Also on page 28, this section would increase the maximum amount of the equipment levy and the facility levy that school districts can do by board action to include the lesser of the sum of the operating capital revenue and the safe schools revenue. The governor's expectation is that with his recommendation on increasing safe schools revenue, one of the uses of safe schools revenue is facility and equipment improvements to schools, and the expectation is that some districts would use part of the money for the facility needs, part of it for other personnel-related needs, and that when they do use money for facility needs, they could do that either on a pay-as-you-go basis or through bonding. So for some schools, they wouldn't have enough money in the increase in safe schools to take care of their facility needs in 1 year, but they could do bonding under current law through the facility levy or the equipment levy in the debt service fund. There's then a subtraction from the general fund levy, in this case the safe schools levy, to help pay for that, but it allows the district to spread that cost out. They can take care of the need right now and then pay for it over a period of several years using their safe schools revenue. And then Article 5.
I'm sorry, we have a question. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Melcher, in being able to use this money kind of fluidly, is that going to create problems for the legislature in the future when they've used the money for the safe schools part and their long-term maintenance kind of things are going to create a problem, not having the money for their long-term maintenance because now that's building up because maybe they're not fixing the roof or they're fixing the roof 3 years later than they anticipated, and so there's more costs adjusted to that. Is that, have you discussed that at all, and could you ease my mind that there's not going to be any major problems for coming back to the legislature saying, well, we just have to spend it on state schools rather than on fixing the furnace?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, the governor's recommendation does not change the long-term facility maintenance. I know there have been some other bills that would provide more flexibility for school districts to use long-term facility maintenance revenue for safe schools. Governor's recommendation doesn't do that. So we would currently have the long-term facility maintenance revenue, fixing the furnace, the roof, et cetera. Nothing changes on that program in the governor's recommendation. What he does do is he adds $36 per pupil to the safe schools levy. And then school districts could decide, how much of that do I need for additional personnel costs? Do I want to hire more school resource officers? Do I need more counselors, school psychologists for mental health kinds of issues? Or do I want to use some of that $36 increase for facility improvements? And if I do, then I can do that either on a pay-as-you-go basis to take care of things I can take care of, finance that way, or if I've got like a relatively big project and I want to take part of that $36 increase over the next, you know, 5 years and use that to bond to pay for a major improvement in the security of the building, I can do that. But it doesn't touch the long-term facility maintenance revenue.
And so the fluid, the local control part of it comes from the new money.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Murphy. And currently, school districts can use the safe schools money for either the staffing or for the facilities. But there's just not enough money to do both right now. And most districts are using most of the money for the personnel costs, the school resource officers and the school counselors, school psychologists, that sort of thing. So this provides new money. So if you're in a school district that, let's say, last year you just took care of all your facility, you know, you did a big bond issue and you paid for all that, you could take the $36 per pupil and use it for the mental health side of things, or for school resource officers. And the other school district sitting next to you that hasn't passed a bond issue to take care of some of those facility needs, they could say, well, for us a priority is to make sure we have safe entrances. And they could use the $36 for that purpose. So there's that flexibility there. But in the governor's budget, we don't change the long-term facility maintenance.
Thank you, Mr. Melcher. When you speak slower, I understand it better. That clarifies. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Adoshuni, Article 5 is libraries. There's just one section. This would transfer unspent funds under the Regional Library Telecommunications Aid to Telecommunications Equity Aid for districts and charters that employ a licensed media specialist or a licensed librarian.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you explain why there's approximately $350,000 unspent?
Mr. Ernie.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, so there's two reasons. One is that the cost for connectivity have gone down, and the need for at these regional libraries has gone down, as well as the need for the infrastructure that they would purchase. Those needs have gone down as they've built those up. So the demand for the funds that are available have gone down based on the fact that some of those needs in that area have already been met.
And Representative Murphy.
There was about $2.3 million in the first place in that fund?
Madam Chair, yeah. Representative Murphy, it's about, I think, $2.3 million a year.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Uni.
All right. Okay. I think we can keep going.
Madam Chair, we can continue on with Article 6, it's Early Childhood and Family Support. The first section is around the formative measures used for the voluntary pre-kindergarten program. It just clarifies that the versions that are to use for that are to be used for the formative measures just be age appropriate.
Madam Chair and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Article 6, Section 2 is deleting some obsolete language. On page 31, it is reflecting the governor's recommendation to continue the School Readiness Plus program and to codify the language that was enacted as one-time language last year as 124D.152. It would also allocate the, when the allocations are done for the voluntary pre-kindergarten and School Readiness Plus programs, it would divide the money based on five groups rather than four groups, so it would take the Minneapolis and St. Paul group and make them separate groups. That would not change the total amount of money going to Minneapolis and St. Paul, but it would ensure that the money that is split proportionally, or the number of seats go proportionately to the two schools rather than one getting a lot more money than the other because they have, let's say, one district has a school with 98% poverty and one has a school with 97% poverty. Under current law, all the money would go to the highest school on the list, and this would just allow for a more equal distribution of the seats between the Minneapolis and the St. Paul school districts. And then Article 6, Section 3 is the governor's recommendation to continue the current cap of 7,160 participants from 2019 and to increase that by 5% a year in 2020, another 5% in 2021. So the cap would grow to 7,518 in 2020 and 7,894 in 2021, rather than being reduced to 3,160 starting in fiscal year 2020.
Madam Chair, Section 4. This expands the eligibility for early childhood scholarships to 0 through 5 years old. Section 5 also pertains to scholarships. However, it's with the administration. It extends the time that MDE has to spend scholarship funding from 24 to 27 months. This allows more time for parents to use scholarships once they've been awarded and for the agency to reallocate funds that were not used by the original recipients. This also includes administration by the regional administrators. Even with careful forecasting, it's pretty hard for an administrator to be 100% accurate matching funds with need because scholarships, as you all know, can be layered with other funding sources. So this can change the calculations once families access those other funding streams, and that becomes apparent to the regional administrator or the school. or other pathway to provider. Because the family has 12 months to use the award from the award date, this makes the forecasting pretty difficult. And then, pardon me, on Section 6, this puts the Help Me Grow program, as you know, with the governor's proposal is $1.5 million a year for Help Me Grow. This puts the program into statute. Just briefly, the program creates a system of access, information, referral, and follow-up for pregnant families with children from birth to 8. This is an interagency collaboration between MDE, DHS, and MDH. Partnership helps with provider outreach, access to detection tools, and linking families with community-based services. The program develops a centralized access point for information, support, and services, and the program also collects data on how the system is working.
And Mr. Ernie, do you know how much DHS is spending on this program right now? Because I know we did not fund it in our last budget, so, and it's in existence.
Madam Chair, I don't have that information, but I believe my colleague, Ms. Nguyen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Wayne Nguyen at the Minnesota Department of Education. So there is a difference between Minnesota's current Help Me Grow and the expanded Help Me Grow that is included in this proposal. Currently, the Minnesota Help Me Grow is funded through the Minnesota Department of Education through special education funding dollars.
And do you know how much of those dollars?
I unfortunately do not know that off the top of my head. I know that right now we are funding about one staff person to staff it, and she'll take the intake for forms and questions and stuff. And really then we, and then it's a system of referral back to school districts to do special education screening. And making sure that the kids are getting the services that they need. The current Minnesota Help Me Grow is really limited to special education services for children, whereas this would be a much more expanded version, and it would open it up to other children and families as well.
All right, thank you. I appreciate that clarification. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Mr. Ernie can answer this perhaps. In the annual review, is that a report that will come to the legislature so we know how, if this becomes a part of the statute that Help Me Grow is fulfilling these 3 points that are laid out in the review under sub-4? Page 37.
Wait. Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, as the language is written, it's not directly provided to the legislature, but that information, I'm sure, could be provided to the legislature.
Do you need a follow-up?
I'm sorry, I can't see.
Thank you. I'm sorry, thank you. Okay, thank you. All right, any other questions? Okay. Oh, Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we're asking questions on this section, I just had a quick question on Section 4 for the early learning scholarships and expanding the age limit from 3 to 5 to any child under 5. I'm just curious the reasoning behind that when we currently have wait lists for children, why we'd want to expand the age range.
The reason that we have proposed this is the advocates in the field have said that the earlier that you start, as well as the research supports, the earlier you start with children, especially low-income children, the better off we are in terms of meeting the outcomes in kindergarten readiness.
Representative Wills?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't necessarily disagree with that, and I think that there's benefits there, but I guess I'm just concerned that we wouldn't be able to reach more children if we already have wait lists that we need to address. So maybe something we can think about moving forward.
Representative Thiessen?
Thank you. Just on that question, do we know how many fewer three or five-year-olds will get services if we go with this proposal?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, we don't know how many will or will not, because we don't know who will apply for the scholarships when they go out to the administrators. So I'm not sure we could get a good number on that. I could certainly see if there's some data in terms of the teenage moms who are getting the earlier services for kids and where are the current services being located, but I'm not certain how that would impact the current four-year-olds getting the scholarships now.
Representative,
and so do we, are there protections built in so people won't lose them, lose scholarships?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I could ask Bobby Burnham to speak to it. I do think we, once you get a scholarship, you keep it. So you get to keep it. So it wouldn't be like you'd be kicked off. And there is a sibling preference, I believe, as well. It's been a while since I looked at the prioritization of how those go out. And they do go out based on low income. So I think that that's important to know as well.
Other questions right now? Okay, I think we'll keep moving through then. Thank you for coming back to the table, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. We're at Article 6, Section 7, and on the bottom of page 37, the governor is recommending that we strike the separate calculation of pupil units for kindergarten students with a disability, so that the pupil units for those students would be calculated in exactly the same manner as kindergarten students without a disability. Currently, we're a little bit out of alignment. The kindergarten students with a disability are required to have 875 hours to generate a pupil unit, and the kindergarten students without a disability are only required to have 850 hours. And also, the kindergarten students with a disability don't qualify for targeted services funding while they're in kindergarten or the year after or the summer after kindergarten, because the pupil unit limit for them is based on the entire fiscal year. So those students, if they need the services, it would be appropriate to fund that the same as we do for kindergarten students without a disability. So there's a little bit of added cost to that, and we're carrying $153,000 in the general ed appropriation in Article 1 for that purpose. Also, on page 38, line 14, there's also a striking language that limits the pupil units for the School Readiness Plus program to fiscal years 18 and 19, because the governor is recommending that that continue in fiscal 20 and later.
Madam Chair, Adoshunia, the next set of sections are section 10 through 13. This has to do with a federal requirement that requires Head Start programs to be DHS, receive background checks from DHS. Currently, DHS is not authorized to provide these background studies for license-exempt Head Start programs or that receive CCAP funds or tribal Head Start programs. So this would give them direct authority to conduct those background studies and comply with the federal requirements that would require these Head Start programs to be fully implementing these background checks by September 30th of 2018. Madam Chair, Section 14, again, this is just a technical section related to making sure that the entrance assessments are age appropriate, the entrance measures are age appropriate for the School Readiness Plus programs.
Madam Chair, Tom Melcher, Department of Education. Article 6, Section 15 is striking one-time language for the School Readiness Plus program, and on page 44 of the bill is cross-referencing the application procedures for the voluntary pre-K program. When this was one-time language, it pretty much paralleled the voluntary pre-K application process, and this would just cross-reference that other language. Section 16 is also, because of the governor's recommendation that School Readiness Plus continue after 2019, is striking the 2019 sunset on that, and also eliminating the term mixed delivery revenue and just referring to voluntary pre-K and School Readiness Plus. And Section 18, I'll just skip that and you come back. Section 18 is a repealer. It's repealing the sunset on the School Readiness Plus pupil unit calculations. So you need to do Section 16.
Madam Chair, Adoshuni, Section 17 is a revisor instruction to codify the School Readiness Plus legislation from 2017.
We're good.
And that concludes Article 6. Okay, Madam Chair, Article 7, Self-Sufficiency and Lifelong Learning. Sections 1 and 2, which comprise Article 7, is the proposal to fully fund the cost of taking the commissioner-selected high school equivalency test, and this would pay for one battery of tests. Madam Chair, Article 8, State Agencies, Section 1, is funding for the Help Me Grow program. And Section 2 reallocates $600,000 in funding for severance payments to for Perpich, and that won't be spent to invest it in technology updates. Madam Chair, that concludes the walkthrough of the Governor's Budget Bill.
All right. Thank you both gentlemen. Any other questions of either Mr. Melcher, Mr. Ooney, or the Commissioner? Representative Debbie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe a question of the Commissioner. Issue a little tangential to the bill, but regarding, I'll put it in regarding Article 7, Section 1, I guess. The ABE, payment for ABE tests. And Commissioner, my concern, I'm using that as a step off. I only learned recently that the only adult basic ed licensure program in the state is being closed at the end of this year. And that, I think, probably presents a challenge going forward for adult learners looking to be taught by licensed instructors. And I'm wondering what you may be aware of this and what your perspective would be on that.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, you know, I haven't heard that. I know that we had this similar problem with CTE teachers, and I know that within the higher ed community they've been discussing that in terms of licensure areas. So that's something I'd have to get back to you about. I know that we have a number of adult basic ed teachers within our school districts and our community ed offices. And they do a wonderful job with our students. So they get very creative. We had a case just a few days ago with someone from Finland and earning their GED and just really working with them. So they're just really great people who do yeoman's work. So I'm sure they'd get creative about it. Certainly wouldn't want to miss the opportunity of allowing for all the people who need to take it. As I shared with you when we presented the governor's budget and recommendations, when he first put out a supplemental budget, the number of additional participants in taking the test was fairly substantial, in the thousands more taking the test when the barrier of the fee was removed. And at just $120 per test, it just seems like something we can do when we spend so much on these students pre-K through 12 when they don't actually earn their diploma. It's also a way for us to support our adult diploma, which we worked really hard on that language a few years ago to allow for, especially those in the correctional facilities that we have, to not only take GED, which we know impacted the amount of our folks who are in corrections to take when the costs are expensive. It's harder for them to take it. And so I think that this also allows for those folks to get a second chance and to get an opportunity to take the GED along with their adult diploma. So you take, you know, if you pass reading, for instance, but you have all your math credits from high school, and you have some work experience for maybe some CTE elective credits, then you can all put all that together in an adult diploma and earn your adult diploma. So those things together, I think, really do provide a nice package, an option for our older adults who, older, you know, kids who never have earned their high school equivalency.
Representative Abney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I appreciate the goals here. I guess You touched on the VOTEC or the CTE issues, and I guess Chair Erickson and Chair Loon, there seems to be an issue of, I'll call them orphan licensures, where there are not a lot of candidates for the licensure programs, but there's still a need for licensed teachers in those areas. If I recall correctly, when the Minnesota branch of the National Federation of the Blind came on their day on the Hill and visited with me, I think we might be at a point where there's no licensure program for blind education in Minnesota. And again, it's a low incidence issue, and so it's hard on the higher ed end to make the economics of offering a program work. But we still have blind kids, and we still have adult learners who need a certificate, a degree. They need a piece of paper so they can move forward. We've got all sorts of folks looking for CTE options, and we have a declining number of qualified and licensed adults to fill those needs. And there might be something there that we're not going to obviously get to this year, but perhaps we should all get on our agenda for the future. So, thank you all.
Noted. Thank you. Representative Teasley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just kind of from a larger perspective here, and it's not just the governor's budget, but spending $20 million this year for school security and another $10 million in the future, and that's money, obviously, that we could spend just going to the classroom, right, if we're not spending on school security. Do we have any evidence that facility enhancements or even SROs is going to save a single life in the state of Minnesota?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, I think there's definitely studies, and I would have to go back and find those for you, and I could certainly get them to you, that show positive impacts around student achievement for healthy and safe school communities, healthy learning environments for children in which to learn. You see a lot of schools now shifting their furniture so that the learning pedagogies and the way that teachers teach in the classroom is different. I don't know about SROs necessarily as a strategy, but those are local decisions on what they think is going to keep their building safe. But the Safe Schools funding that we have absolutely helps our schools be more safe, and it does impact learning when children come to school and they're feeling fearful, and certainly the past 3 to 5 months have been quite traumatizing for many of our students in terms of going to school. So doing less, I don't think, is an option, and doing nothing, I think, is not an option. I think that we have to provide more funding to schools around safe schools. And in particular, we have a number of elementary schools in our rural areas that still don't have locked doors or doorbells or other video equipment that could help prevent or deter anything from occurring. And so I think there's nothing more important in terms of the funding than providing a safe school for our kids and securing our doors. That should be absolutely done in every single elementary school. Those doors should be locked, and there should be should have a buzzer to get in during the hours that children are there.
Representative Teasley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't disagree on the safe schools, using it for some of the things you were talking about, to make the climate safer and to have mental health experts and those kind of things. But the research I've done shows that investing in the school security enhancements, some of the things you're talking about, make no difference whatsoever. And so I don't know that's what I'm asking. Do you have any other research that supports that, or are we just doing stuff because we think it's going to make a difference and it's going to make us feel better? I would rather we take this $20 million and put it into mental health.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, there's a lot we need to be doing more. Quite honestly, we're still funding our schools at 2003 levels. We have a number of schools that are strained with their growing special education cross-subsidy, no doubt. So there's a lot we could be doing. And we should be raising more revenue, obviously, and that's just not a popular idea right now. But we could be doing a lot more for our students if we were really serious about dealing with the urgent gaps that are persisting. And $20 million to make our schools more safe, I think, is a small investment. We put in over $9 billion in our school. We should absolutely make sure that they're safe.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And we could put that into special ed, and it would double what you're going to do and would make action probably, it arguably could make a bigger difference. But that's for a later discussion.
So we lose a life.
So, I mean, but this is my point, Commissioner, that you have no evidence that it's not, that it's going to save a life. That's, but
well, let
we
me
can
try
get
the
that.
Evidence and get it to
so,
you then.
Please do.
And make sure.
So the other question I have is, we spend $100 million a year, just about a biennium, excuse me, on the literacy incentive aid.
Mm-hmm. Now we're starting.
Do you think that that's the highest and best use of those dollars, or if we put $100 million into the basic education formula, or more importantly, maybe into special ed, we could have a bigger impact on improving student outcomes?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen. In 2011, we thought we would be able to see really fast results by doing kind of a merit pay type of system and structuring a bipartisan agreement around reading well by third grade. And we did. We saw increases, huge increases in gap closure in our 2013 NAEP. But what happens with merit-based types of programs, similar to QCOMP, those kinds of things, performance-based types of programs, is you see a spike and then it drops off in levels. And so, especially when school districts, and the superintendents won't like this so well, but, you know, in local school boards, when there's local control around how the money is spent with very little transparency, then those funding don't go to literacy. So you have, and when they have to fill the gaps that I just talked about, when there's underfunding in special ed or underfunding in the general ed program, then that money goes to fill the plug. And so there's little that I can prove that those literacy funds are actually being spent on literacy any longer. I think they were at first for those first 2 years, and I think we saw our scores increase. And then I think as budgets tightened, they stopped putting the money in literacy and started just kind of using that however they needed to use it. It could be for literacy, or it could be for math, or it could be for whatever they wanted. And then there's no transparency. This is similar to my concern around compensatory funding and school districts having 50% ability to use the compensatory however they want. As there's a recent article in Duluth Public Schools about the lack of transparency on how that compensatory is being funded. As you know, compensatory is for poor kids. Our poor kids are scoring poorer and poorer on our exams, and our disparities are growing. And that money needs to be spent on the kids that are generating the funding. And with literacy aid, if we intend for that to work for literacy, then it should be put toward literacy, and especially teaching the ELA standards, which I've talked with Representative Harrison about. Our teachers need additional professional development and support in unpacking the Common Core ELA standards.
Thank
Get
you.
Me talking passionately about that.
Thank you. All right. Good discussion. Other questions? No? Okay. All right. Other questions for the commissioner or for testifiers, or should we go to testifiers who wanted to present their thoughts? We'll do that. All right. Thank you very much,
thank
Commissioner.
You so much.
Mr. Uni, Mr. Dr. Melcher, thank you. And Ms. Nguyen as well. Hold from the department. All right. So I'm just going to go ahead and call out names. Please make your way down to the testifier table, and I'll let you know the next couple of people up on deck, and then if you want to move closer so we can get through this reasonable fashion. Brad Lundell, Gary Amoroso, Mary Gilbert, Sam Walsap. First up. And please just identify yourselves for the record, and thank you for your testimony.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Brad Lundell here today, mostly for school strike and education, but I also have some comments from Minnesota Administrators of Special Education. We're supportive of several measures that are in the governor's budget. I think first and foremost, whether or not it's enough money, and of course there never is enough money, but I think the thing is that the school safety revenue changes that are in the bill are things that we do support. There's equalization in this as they equalize the levy. I think that the question, we're always for more equalization of levies, but by the same token, That's equalized at a very low rate, and so I think the question is how much bang for the buck are you getting for that equalization, but I do think that it's a good move on the part of the governor to promote that. Also, the attention towards special education, we think that that's very important. The special education cross-subsidy for schools for equity and education districts continues to rise. We know that there's other bills that are floating around the legislature this year. I know that Representative Knobloch has a bill. I think that a good discussion of special education, whether or not you deal with the basic formulas within the special education formula or create a new component, as Representative Knobloch does, I think that's a good discussion to have, and we'll see where that ends up. Also, making the school readiness permanent is also something we're supportive of. We have a number of districts that are working on that and are participating. We think that making that permanent so they can plan and move forward with that is important. Also, again, want to thank Dr. Melcher and for pointing out that the local option revenue change, I think, is an important change as well, because I've, you know, just a short anecdote. I worked with a school district where the vote yes committee became the vote no committee, because had they passed the levy, because of how the local option revenue and the referendum worked together, they would have actually gotten less money had they successfully passed the referendum. So I think that Dr. Melcher's pointed out there is some confusion there, and I think making that change is very appropriate. So with that, and again, I did want to say on behalf of MACE as well that they do support the special education attention and more money going into that farm bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Amoroso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary Amoroso, Executive Director, Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I want to thank the Chair for the opportunity to share a couple of thoughts. First off, we want to thank the governor. The governor made a commitment that every year that he was in office that he would increase funding for E-12 education. And with the work with the legislature, the governor has kept that commitment and is attempting to continue to keep that commitment with his last budget. As we've talked about before in front of the committee, we're very thankful for the conversation about increasing the school revenue increase for safe schools. And we're also pleased that we're looking at some type of a floor, which will have a significant impact on those districts that have a smaller number of students. So we appreciate the floor concept in the budget. We've heard from some of our districts that are starting to not get the type of dollars that they thought they'd have in the area of QCOMP. While this is only a small portion of our districts, and while it may only be 1 or 2%, if it's something that could be adjusted now, it could save us resources down the road. Also, thank you for the conversation about increasing the special education dollars. We all know what the cross-subsidy looks like. We appreciate Chair Erickson looking at putting a task force together. We also support that task force. And so whether we put some additional resources in for next year or not, I still think we would need the task force to look at a long-term solution. And then also, I've heard from some of our districts that also went into the School Readiness Plus program that have concerns about what are they going to do when the funding runs out after this biennium. There is now an expectation that's starting to be gained within those communities, and the concern is if the funding is not increased or provided, I should say, will they have to continue to do that from one of the other sources within their systems? And that is causing them some concerns. With that, Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity and would stand for any questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Amoroso. Mr. Walsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member Sam Walsh, and if I could wear two hats here very briefly. First, on behalf of the Minnesota Library Association, I appreciate the question from Representative Murphy and the conversation about the change in Article 5. It was kind of news to the regional library systems that there were unspent funds in the regional library telecommunications aid program. Had a chance to meet with the regional library directors around the state. They're trying to get their arms wrapped around what's going on with RLTA. It sounds as Mr. Uni indicated that prices for broadband are coming down. There are also Category 2 expenses that are eligible for RLTA for equipment purchases that I think the directors want to take a look at and see if there's some need there as well. So we're trying to understand if that's a one-time blip or if this is going to be an ongoing trend in RLTA funding. But in the meantime, we would ask that this committee and the department consider, instead of repurposing those dollars for school telecom equity needs, to instead keep those public library resources within the public library world and instead repurpose those dollars to the regional library basic system support program and specifically the base aid portion of that formula. So we'd ask for your consideration of that as opposed to redirecting those dollars into the school telecom equity program. Appreciate your support for that consideration. And Madam Chair, members, on behalf of the Minnesota Rural Education Association, we'll echo a lot of the comments you've heard from the other school district folks. Do want to thank the governor and the department for the school safety proposal and in particular the inclusion of the cooperative educational entities that exist in rural Minnesota in addition to the intermediates. You heard a bill a couple of weeks ago. Representative Haley had a bill to do a similar proposal to include those educational intermediate cooperative units. As Dr. Amoroso said, we appreciate the nod for additional school readiness funding. And special education, very interested in this topic and appreciate you hearing Chairman Knobloch's bill tomorrow. It provides a little bit more targeted focus for special education and buying down some of the most egregious cross-subsidies. So appreciate the chance, for Madam Chair, members available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wassa. Ms. Gilbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools. And I think the three big funding proposals that the governor recommended are key. That's school safety, the special education, in spite of the fact that we're going to be looking at what's driving some of the costs and what's causing the cross-subsidy. I think this is a small down payment that would go a long way to making a commitment toward addressing the cross-subsidy. As far as the voluntary pre-K and school readiness proposal, we have 280 students that we won't be able to guarantee a spot next year unless the base funding is continued. And that is extremely problematic for us as we do our school choice fair in January and we enroll students in the spring, and that will leave all those slots up in the air for those students. And these are students that have barriers to attending private or other preschool opportunities because of their inability to pay, their inability to get transportation, or the fact that these students need EL or special education services. So this is a large group of kids that would really benefit from some certainty in families that they would be having some certainty about their spot available for them. We also really appreciate the fact that the governor included putting Minneapolis and St. Paul in its own region. We've been working hard with Minneapolis to try and make sure there is an equitable distribution, but having it clarified in statute would go a long way. I also want to thank the governor for provisions that aren't in your committee, but around mental health services, homework starts at home. We served over 2,000 homeless students last year, and I can tell you the marked difference in outcomes of kids that have stable housing versus the ones that are moving or sleeping in cars, which we noticed when we had our snow day a couple weeks ago that we did have parents sleeping in cars in our parking lot when we went to check on schools. And finally, the infusion for the GED. We do have a large number of adults that are using the GED, which is a first step at successfully gaining employment and working with our adult basic education program. So it does go a long way. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. All right. Let's see. Next up, Erica Moss, Scott Kringquist, Kurt Treitstad, and Jim Bartholomew. So any of those people are here? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Erica Moss. I'm the Executive Director of Close Gaps by Five. And we're focused on using early education to close early learning opportunity gaps that lead to Minnesota's achievement gaps, which I know you're all aware of and which we all agree are a huge threat to our state. So we've worked with bipartisan leaders to promote early education policies that are aligned with four things that the research says we must do to close gaps. First, we need to start early. Second, we need to target limited resources to the most vulnerable first. Third, demand quality. And fourth, ensure the flexibility needed to keep families and children at the center of our policymaking. Early learning scholarships were designed specifically to do those four things. And the problem with scholarships is that an estimated 35,000 low-income Minnesota children under age 5 aren't able to get scholarships because of lack of funds. We appreciate the governor's past support helping to bring scholarships statewide and wouldn't be here today without his leadership and the support of committee members all around the table. while we support the eventual idea of expanding scholarship eligibility to include more of our vulnerable babies and toddlers, doing so without any new investment is sort of an expansion in name only, and we don't think that it's going to lead us to any of our shared goals. So I think making that change without an increase in funding is not a wise policy decision. Instead, of course, the governor's proposal does include investment in universal or voluntary pre-K, which we've expressed reservations about in recent years. From our perspective, it's a well-intended policy, but when it comes to meeting the criteria that I mentioned earlier, what the research says we need to do to really address our achievement gaps, it doesn't line up well. Waiting until children are 4 years old for a part day program that runs part year is just help that comes a little bit too late for them and is too small of an amount of help to unfortunately address those gaps, which we know open and can be measured as early as 9 months of age. So for those reasons, we'd urge the committee to, if there's any opportunity, Madam Chair, invest as much as possible in early learning scholarships and to not move forward at this point with that policy change to open up eligibility without any new investment. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Grunquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Scott Grunquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and thank you for the opportunity to offer a few brief comments. You start off by saying we very much appreciate and thank the governor for the level of investment that he is proposing in our schools. I'll highlight a couple of the key points that we think and that are items that are on our platform. Starting off with special education, and again, you all know that this is a major issue, one of the primary, if not the biggest reason that so many of our school districts continue to face budget challenges is the underfunding of special education. So that is very welcome. I would also like to express our support for the making the pre-K, the school readiness permanent. We have a number of districts that we'll look at reduced funding next year and have a real difficult time keeping those programs going absent that funding. Also, are strongly supportive of the QCOMP investment to make sure that we don't prorate. We'd obviously like to see QCOMP increase because, as you know, there are a number of districts actually on the waiting list that would like to get into the program, but at a minimum, at least making sure there's no proration would be very helpful. And then, of course, you've had a lot of discussion about the Safe Schools issues this year, and we are supportive of increasing the Safe Schools levy and, in fact, then turning it into an equalized levy and making it bonded debt allowable. Will create, give a lot greater flexibility to school districts to address a number of issues. And then lastly, I'd like to address the proposed changes in the referendum and local optional revenue. There is a lot to be said for streamlining that and reducing the confusion, and generally I think we would support the direction that's going. One caution, I guess, or downside that I would point out is that if you move that $300 away from referendum revenue to local optional revenue, a growing number of districts now put an inflationary increase on their referendum questions, and so that if you are one of those districts, and again it's a growing number, you will be losing that inflationary component for that $300 that gets moved over. One way you could address that potentially, at least somewhat mitigate it, is to leave the referendum cap where it is and not lower it. That would at least give districts some flexibility to go back and recoup some dollars. And also with a growing number of districts at or near the cap, you would just have a safety valve in place for when the state is facing difficult financial challenges. At least allow a school district an option to go out and ask their community to support some additional revenue. So I'll stop with that, Madam Chair, members. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grunquist. Dr. Trigstad.
My name is Kurt Trigstad, and I'm the Executive Director of the Perpich Center for the Arts. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to address you today. I'd like to add some context and rationale to the section of the Governor's supplemental budget relating to the Perpich Center. Specifically, it's the language that starts on page 46 with line 23 that requests the reappropriation of funds for other uses. The 2017 legislative session appropriated $1.2 million to the Perpich Center to be used for severance payments related to the closure of the Crosswinds Arts and Science School. These funds are available until June 30th, 2019. To date, the Purpich Center has expended $323,300 of that fund related to crosswind severance. This leaves a remaining balance of $876,700. We've estimated that the Purpich Center has a potential exposure to future unemployment benefits and other severance payments for crosswind employees of about $255,000. That estimate is based on assumptions of the number of staff who could still be eligible for unemployment benefits, who have not received the maximum of the 26-week eligibility benefit period, and a payout of a grievance filed on behalf of the crosswinds employees represented by SRSEA. The agency does have a high need for technology improvement. Agency leadership has worked with staff to develop a 5-year plan for technology adoption. That plan is closely aligned with current needs and implementation of the agency's 2017 strategic plan. Our employees were all involved with the description of the current technology environment, envisioning the technology's role for the future of the agency. This planning process supported the findings of the OLA program report, asking us to involve staff in decision-making processes. Technology categories included everything from infrastructure to devices to telecommunications, etc. And our plan was presented to our board of directors and has their support. So the Purpich Center is requesting that $600,000 of the severance appropriation be reappropriated to Purpich for the use of technology improvements. A quick review of the current status of the technology at Purpich Center shows several things. Our infrastructure is between 15 and 20 years old. We're surviving on Cat 5 cabling, which does not have a large bandwidth ability. Our Wi-Fi access is very limited and spotty and unreliable within our buildings, all the buildings on campus. Our switches and routers are outdated, and printers are approaching the end of life. Our computers that our staff use, the last significant upgrade for high school staff computers was 2012, and those devices are mostly desk models. At times, we've been upgraded by hand-me-down devices from other state agencies, and we're thankful for that, but it's not new equipment. Outreach Division did give new computers in 2014, but that was only 6 computers at the time. We also have a need for upgrading our classroom technology. The majority of our current student lab devices are 2012 vintage or older, the exception being we have bought 23 new computers mid-year this year to support the media arts program that relies really heavily on technology to edit photos and video. Current devices are lack the reliability, and not all technology is functional. Lab computers, software printers, functioning smart boards or projectors are just to name a few. Another need that we have is video conferencing capabilities. We do not have robust video conferencing or webinar capabilities at site. It does limit some of the curricular uses, but will affect the agency's ability to reach the arts educators across the state. We've developed a relationship with the service co-ops to serve as our anchors across the state, and those service co-ops do have robust technology capabilities if we can only connect to them. A reality is that the arts content specialists that we have on site must leverage technology to provide the professional development required at statute. The 4 of them simply cannot physically provide services to our state. Our goal is to provide a hybrid model that leverages technology to meet that need. And lastly, as you've heard from others today, we do have an urgency part of, we need our own technology upgrades and our security. We have needs in terms of updating our entrances with entrance buzzers and video, as well as our security cameras, which are still all analog-based. So the main points are we need to update our infrastructure. If nothing else, doesn't matter how good of machines we have, if you don't have the infrastructure to run it, it simply doesn't matter. So we want to update all our cabling. We need to do a device refresh. We need to think about whether we're going to move toward new computer labs or toward the one-to-one student devices, as many districts have done around the state. We need that video conferencing that I just discussed, and we need the security upgrades. So although it's not included in this request, please know that we understand that simply upgrading the technology itself is not going to make all the difference. We have a process in place for reviewing and upgrading our internal professional development opportunities for our staff. It's a tool that assists and expands the possibilities for deep learning by students and adults. But we do need to move to a place where technology support and training needs become proactive and not reactive. From a planning and implementation standpoint, I'd just like to assure the committee of my ability to lead a major technology adoption. Chair Loon and Representative Kreisha have observed my leadership in their home districts where I've led large technology integration projects, and both of those projects are still thriving. So I do know how to get this done in an efficient, cost-effective manner. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. Thank the Governor's Office for including us this. And with that, I would stand for any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Trick. So actually, Representative Juergens, I believe, has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, Dr. Last time you were here, you were asked about the enrollment numbers for the upcoming school year. Can you give us an update since you were last here?
So we are still in that in-between stage. I'm sorry, Representative Chair. The in-between stage between the first go-around with kids, you know, applying for application, and middle of April is when we make the final determination on numbers. So I don't have a number for you today.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. You. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Being last, I'll be brief. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I want to thank you for the opportunity to briefly comment on the governor's proposal. And really just wanted to highlight one item, and that's we'd ask that you not adopt the proposed change in Article 2, Section 1, specifically page 15, that would repeal the requirement that MDE provide families with information about student progress towards college and career readiness in grades 3 through 8. This is something that was passed just a couple years ago, and we think is a valuable source of information for families. While the repeal was one of the recommendations from last year's OLA report, its net impact is to reduce the amount of information that we provide to families. It does not streamline the testing process. The goal of the legislation was to give families early indications of how their students are doing so that they could act in a timely manner to help their students succeed. And with that goal in mind, we'd hope that you keep this reporting requirement in place so families can track how their kids are doing and intervene sooner rather than later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. All right, Valerie Dolesland, John Claver, Mike Chang, and Denise Dietrich. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Valerie Dolesland, and I'm here today representing the intermediate school districts. I'd like to thank the chair and the committee members for their past support of the intermediate initiatives that we've brought forward to the legislature in the past. And I'd like to thank the governor and the department today for their work to include the intermediates and the service co-ops in the Safe Schools Levy proposal. And I also just wanted to remind members, I know a lot of the conversations about safe schools have been about infrastructure, but school districts and intermediates and co-ops can use the Safe Schools Levy for other things like support personnel, staff, chemical health counselors, et cetera, and things like that. So it's not just used for infrastructure. I'd like to just reiterate our support for that proposal and look forward to continuing the conversation.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Dawson. Welcome.
Hi. I'm here to testify for the investment for the Help Me Grow expansion. I'm a mother of four children.
I'm sorry. Could you introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Mai Chang.
Thank you.
I'm a mother of four children, 2, 3, 4, and 9. I'm here today because I have had a great opportunity to be part of the development of the current Help Me Grow system, and to also share that I have used the current system personally for one of my children who was at that time 1 year old and who had who I had developmental concerns about. He went on to obtain early intervention services, and before his third birthday, he was able to exit early childhood special education. I don't know what I would have done without the support because of the ease of Help Me Grow system. I have also had experience with another child who is now 9 years old, but was 3 and a half at that time when I had concerns about his developmental growth. And the Help Me Grow referral system was not established at that time as well. As a parent who had moved from another state into Minnesota with one child whom I had developmental concerns about, I had no idea who to go to or where to start. I learned then it is a state law here in Minnesota that all children must receive the early childhood screening before entering kindergarten. It was promoted to get that done at the age of 3. My child did at that time go through the district and get assessed, but to find that he was not eligible for those services because he was right below the cutoff line to qualify, and because I fought for him through our complex systems, he didn't, until 7 years old, qualify for early childhood special education services. Between 3 and 7 years, I lived and went through a broken system or lack of a system to support families like me. I will share, I was poor back then, barely making $30,000 a year, but made the hard decision to sacrifice and limit my hunger so that I could pay out of pocket for private therapy for him. I know that not all families are able to make that sacrifice, but this is my story. When I look back from where I was then to where I am now, I am sad, and it angers me that there wasn't more help for me to succeed as a parent. The current Help Me Grow is a referral system to find children who may be eligible for special education services. There is no other collaborative state system to assist and support parents seeking help for their young children outside of that. The expanded Help Me Grow that I'm here to really talk about and really advocate for is going to be the most pivotal gateway for siblings, aunts, uncles, expecting mothers, parents, foster providers, medical educational providers to learn and have the ability to access the many different state and local services and programs, not just special education services. My child and I receive daily services and supports, and I know that many others out there would have appreciated to know and be well informed of what was available to them at that time. Hence, I truly believe that financial investment now and long-term for Help Me Grow expansion is going to be critical for the health and well-being for young children and families to succeed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Ms. Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to the governor's budget proposal. Since this is the governor's last supplemental budget, we would like to publicly acknowledge him for honoring his commitment to put new revenue into public education each year in office. And so he has, like we said, honored that commitment, and we thank him for that. So there are a couple of items that we would like to point out in particular in this bill that we particularly like. The first is the Safe Schools Act, based on three things. The Safe Schools revenue is flexible, and he also includes a floor, and then he has provided equalization along with that. As others have mentioned, the equalization is small, but it is at least a good first step. Second of all is the money that he puts towards the special education cross-subsidy. As we've testified to many times this year, this is one of the highest priorities for school board members across the state. It is just a small amount, but any amount I think will help the work group if passed into law over the interim. And then last but not least, we do appreciate the governor identifying and capturing the library telecom revenue and repurposing it to the telecoms equity aid. It once again is a small amount of money, but we think it is a step in the right direction, and we think that it is needed, and we hope that that can be a stepping stone to eventually fully funding telecom equity aid this legislative session. So with that, Madam Chair, I will conclude my comments.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Ms. Dietrich. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the governor's budget? And I did have John Klaber on the list representing M. Oh, okay. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the governor's budget as presented? Mr. Heller, did you want to testify on the governor's budget? You have to come down to the microphone. Thank you.
Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, while he's coming down, could I just ask for further clarification on Help Me Grow?
Yes.
Do I understand that the Help Me Grow program is more funded with human services dollars, and then that expanded Help Me Grow program that we funded in education from education funding, that is for special education children in addition to the funding that comes from the Department of Human Services for Help Me Grow?
Representative Murphy, that is my understanding. We don't actually provide any direct funding. There's no line item or anything for Help Me Grow in the education budget. It sounds like from previous testimony from the department from Ms. Flynn that there is a full-time employee in special education. I'm guessing maybe that's federally funded position that's being used for this purpose. But maybe should we have the department add a little more context around this? Would that be helpful?
I would appreciate that.
All right. Welcome back.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, that is correct. Currently, the current Minnesota Help Me Grow program is being funded through the Department of Education with early special early childhood special education funds. We are working collaboratively right now with the Department of Human Services and Minnesota Department of Health on an expanded Help Me Grow model in which we are seeking state funding for.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So the money that's in the governor's budget isn't anywhere now right now or in this proposal before us. That isn't anywhere right now. So we don't have an expanded program yet.
Yes, Chair Loon, Representative Murphy, correct. There are no current state dollars being spent on Help Me Grow. So there's no line item in a fiscal sheet that House fiscal analysts would have funding Help Me Grow.
Okay. But you're hopeful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Thank you, Ms. Wynn. Appreciate it. All right, Mr. Heller.
Rick Heller, unofficial representative of the Twice Exceptional People with Disabilities. Just for the record, I've submitted documents to this committee last month. I provided you a copy of that. I went up to the library, print those out on the UFARS, gifted and talented code, on Thursday, March 29th. I did get that posted online, but not at this meeting. Without those documents in front of members, I don't know if I could testify. There's other documents as well as that I forward to your CA as well. I spoke to them yesterday about that as well, that they weren't online yet. And I'm not sure if the other people in the committee here have those documents, so if I can ask the chair, do they have those documents?
Mr. Documents from March 29th, from our March 29th meeting, is that what you're asking about?
Correct.
Yeah, we don't have them.
Thank you.
We do not have those, Mr. Heller. So I don't know if you, did you drop those? If you can provide those to me, I can get them distributed to the committee if that's, is that your desire?
Well, I give them out early so people could review them if they wanted to. They're all State Department documents.
Okay, well, if you have specific documents you would like the committee to review, if you can get those to me, either, if not electronically, just to my mailbox, we can have them distributed to the rest of the committee members.
Just that when I sent them ahead of time, and I've been denied to talk for many meetings so far, and I find that very offensive. However, that's the discretion of the chair. And that's one of them. Yeah. That's one of them. Well, you want a whole pile of them? I'll go up and print them. You can pass them out if you want. It's not all the documents, so it doesn't matter. So if it doesn't matter, then it don't matter. I can live with it.
Do you have further testimony, Mr. Heller?
If this committee can't do their due diligence to get documents up in a timely manner so I can connect the dots on the twice exceptional, and I won't be able to testify on the meeting on Thursday on the gifted and talented, because, again, that's one of those meetings that no one gets to testify at because it's an informational hearing. And when you get excluded from that process, and I'm not here for myself, frankly, I'm here for the leaders, they can move ahead on this. My whole thing was Ms. Erickson has the document, she can speak for it, she likes. From Mr. Melcher, he's here, but if the chair doesn't allow questions to be yielded to the chair about what the State Department says about the twice exceptional and how it's not being tracked. It cannot be tracked, not only for programming, which is found in Minnesota Statute 120B15, but for the development of teachers. At the end of this year, they will be the only group that have been identified in the Gifted and Talented program. This year, they have added, it's my understanding, free and reduced lunch for the economically disadvantaged. This whole thing is a disgrace. And if you're going to have an informational hearing and everyone can review information in a timely manner, I'll be glad to come back and talk to you, but I don't want to use up anybody's time. I'm not here for that. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Heller. All right. I do not have or see anyone else, unless there's anyone else who wants to testify on the governor's budget. Oh, Mr. Kringquist, come on down.
Madam Chair, Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metro School Districts, and I just want to correct the record. I was incorrect in my earlier testimony when I said that the governor's I'm talking about the referendum and moving the 300 over to LOR, and we had a concern if some of that was attached to inflation. And, of course, I should have known that Mr. Melcher thought of that. So apparently there is language in the bill that I missed that would address that. So I apologize and want to correct the record.
So
thank you.
We'll put never mind. Thank you, Mr. Kronquist, for clarifying that. All right. So, so those are the testifiers we have who wish to testify on the governor's budget. I do have a list of people who wanted to testify on House File 3315, the policy bill, which has been referred to this committee, and we started on it before break. I guess just wondering, show of hands, we have this room back at 5 o'clock, so if anybody would like to come back to testify, we'd be happy to do that, but I'm happy to accommodate the will of the crowd here. If no one wants to come back, then we can try to either work in some testimony tomorrow during our regular committee time. I think we can. I don't think the bills we have on will take too terribly long. But all right, so who would like to come back at 5 o'clock? Show of hands, nice and high. All right, I think that settles it. So we're going to call it a committee meeting for today. I am, again, renew my motion to lay over House File
4328. Thank you to all those who came and testified, especially the commissioner and her team from the Department of Education. And we will see everyone tomorrow. We are